I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yes.
That was a scene last Friday as the New Jersey Pinelands Commission voted to approve the construction of a 22-mile-long natural gas pipeline. About 10 of the miles of the pipeline will go through the Pinelands. That's 1 million acres of protected forests and wetlands in South Jersey that's part of the National Park Service. As you could hear, it was a loud and contentious meeting. Back in 2014, the commission voted down the pipeline, but a lot has changed in the last few years. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has been following the pipeline story. He was there on Friday for the vote and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Joe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty.
So take us inside that meeting on Friday for the vote.
It was a pretty raucous meeting. This was in a ballroom inside a hotel in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Pretty big room. And it was felt filled with people, about 500, probably more, mostly opponents of the pipeline. A lot of people holding up signs, chanting during the meeting. You heard in that clip, they were actually voting on the pipeline there.
You could hear the little bit of vote in the background.
You could hear the yeses and the roll call, but everyone was kind of confused. Actually, the communications director for the Pinelands Commission had to hold up a sign for all the reporters to say the result because we couldn't hear very well. But there were also supporters of the pipeline in the room, and they were there as well, voicing their support for it.
You've been covering this for a while. Were you surprised at the outpouring of people at this vote?
I don't know if anyone was surprised at the outpouring of people. I mean, this has been a controversial and contentious issue for a while, and it's been building for – I mean, this project goes back to 2012. That was when South Jersey Gas first submitted its initial application. So this has been building and building for a while. And, you know, the Pinelands Commission doesn't usually hold its meetings in a ballroom.
I was wondering about that.
I mean, they knew that there was going to be a huge crowd, and there was.
And did we know the vote before it happened? Was there any mystery about how the commission was going to vote?
Well, it wasn't exactly clear how they were going to vote. How the Pinelands Commission works on these sorts of things is that the staff of the commission, so the administrative and research arms, kind of comes up with a report and recommends to the commissioners how to vote. They say, all right, it meets these guidelines and these rules. We recommend that you approve the pipeline. And they did that for this application. So going into the vote, we knew that the commissioners had the recommendation to approve. We just didn't know how the vote was going to go.
And how was the vote? What were the pros and the cons or the yays or the nays?
9 commissioners voted in favor, 5 opposed, and 1 abstained. This was the second application on this project to come through. The first time it came up for a vote in 2014, it was voted down.
Was it a different? Are we talking about a different commission than in 2014, in terms of the makeup of the commission?
Right. Not very different. I think. I think what was different this time around was that the company South Jersey Gas resubmitted a new application to try to get in line with the rules that it wasn't in line with the first time around.
How did they do that? How did they amend their application?
Well, that is kind of a tricky question, and it's at issue here. It's like one of the main issues here, because when you have public service infrastructure, which is what this is in the Pinelands, it needs to primarily serve only the needs of the Pinelands, which is kind of a confusing term, and courts haven't really figured out yet what that means, and this might be a good case for it. But the first time around, the commission said this doesn't primarily meet only the needs of the Pinelands. This time, that was the first time. This time around, it said it does because for a couple of reasons, but one of which is because the plant where all this natural gas is going to is in the Pinelands, and another reason is because the electricity that will be generated by that natural gas will probably mostly go to people living in the Pinelands. So it's kind of a confusing and very specific argument.
How many people live in the Pinelands? Do you know?
I don't know. It's 7. It's
1 million acres.
It's 1.1 million acres, and it touches 7 counties in South Jersey. And each of those counties is represented on the Pinelands Commission. But a huge number of people in South Jersey live in the zone.
That's Joe Hernandez. And if you want to join our conversation, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499, talking about the vote on Friday by the New Jersey Pinelands Commission, giving the green light for the construction of a natural gas pipeline. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So who were in the supporters? As you said, at least as far as the crowd was concerned on Friday, most of them were opposed to the pipeline. Who were the supporters?
Well, obviously you have South Jersey Gas. They support the pipeline. They say it's needed for a variety of reasons. A lot of supporters are union workers in South Jersey who might get the work of building this pipeline. And they say South Jersey, especially now, I mean, South Jersey has really high unemployment rates. The kind of collapse of the casino industry in Atlantic City has put a lot of people out of jobs. And so they're saying, you know, we could use these jobs in South Jersey. And then you have residents. I mean, some residents do support this and say, we need the backup power source. We need energy now that this coal plant is going to be kind of taken offline. And so this is a good idea.
And what's the argument from the company itself?
Well, there's two arguments. One is that this pipeline will go to a power plant on the Jersey Shore called BL England. And right now it's a coal-fired plant, but it's transitioning off coal onto natural gas. So this pipeline will run right to that plant and deliver natural gas there so it can keep online and generating electricity. The second argument is that it provides a backup power source to people in the area. Right now there's one natural gas pipe. There's one source of natural gas. This would be a second. And supporters say after Superstorm Sandy, that knocked out a lot of infrastructure. We need something like this in the area to provide resiliency.
Now we're talking about 22 miles. What is the route? And it looks like it goes along Route 42.
So it starts in Morris. In Cumberland County. It starts down in Morris River in Cumberland County. Then it travels – it's kind of at the nexus of three counties, really. It travels through Atlantic County a bit, and then it lands in Cape May County, kind of near Ocean City.
And are there pipes – are they going to be buried? Are they going to be visible along the side of the road?
I think both, but I think mostly they're going to be buried. A majority of the route, I think about 19 miles, over 19 miles, would go under roadways, and there's some of it where the company needs to get easements from private property owners.
And about 10 miles or so going through the pinelands. I'm getting pipelands and pinelands confused.
Well,
the pinelands.
Yeah, that was the message on a lot of signs, is pinelands, not pipelands. It's funny you mentioned that. But about 15 miles, I believe, we'll go through the pinelands.
And who are the opponents? I mean, I can imagine who some of them are, but it seemed like a kind of a broad-based group of people.
Well, environmentalists largely oppose the pipeline. They say it's unnecessary for energy. They say it's dangerous, potentially dangerous. Not only could it, you know, leak and hurt water sources, it could cause an explosion or something like that. But also, this is just going through a really protected natural area that politicians in the past have deemed necessary to protect. As some residents oppose this too. I mean, there's the split among residents who think maybe we need the energy and residents who think I don't want this near my home.
I read somewhere that four former governors of New Jersey opposed this pipeline.
Right.
Which is interesting. Obviously, the current governor in support of.
The current governor does not oppose it. He supports it, right. And he's been pushing for it a while. But that's right. And opponents cite that a lot as saying there's we should listen to these four former governors who say that we don't need this.
Now, the Pinelands is part of the National Park Service. So does the federal government have a say at all? You're kind of chortling at me as I ask you that, Joe.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Like, the federally protected area is also a little bit different than the state jurisdiction of the Pinelands, and this passes through part of both. The Pinelands Commission has the say in this, and the Pinelands Commission has 15 members. Seven are appointed by the governor, seven are appointed by the counties, one from each of the counties that it touches, and one is appointed by the U.S. Secretary of the Interior. Actually, that was the
abstention.
Right. He said that he was on the commission too short a time to really be able to make a decision. But I think the long and short of it is the Pinelands Commission, which is made up of those people, will have the say on this.
Let me get a caller in. Looks like we have a caller from the Pinelands. This is Rebecca calling into Radio Times. Hi, Rebecca. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I work for the Pinelands Preservation Alliance, and we'd just like to reiterate that this proves to be a severe threat to the future of the Pinelands, since it violates the rules that protect this very special area. We've filed suit to oppose this project, and it is a real shame to see what happened at the meeting on the 24th.
What are you going to do next? Are you going to file more lawsuits, Rebecca?
We have two suits pending. There are some ethics concerns with the commissioners who had voted on the Pinelands pipeline, but there is an appeal on the procedure that the commission used to approve the pipeline, which is also pending. We filed a motion at the end of the meeting to stay construction of the South Jersey Gas Pipeline, since there are already lawsuits pending, and it would be not in their best interest to move forward with construction since it poses such a threat.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Joe, it sounds like looking ahead, this is not the end of this decision, or at least this back and forth related to the pipe.
Right. And the Pinelands Preservation Alliance is a nonprofit group, and they've been a very loud voice in opposition to this pipeline. The Sierra Club is another one, and they've told me that they're planning to sue as well over the process that was used by the Pinelands Commission to approve this, and also the nature of the project, which they say violates the rules. Now, it should be noted that the Pinelands Commission has found that pipelines are allowed in the Pinelands. And there are different kind of areas within the Pinelands that allow different levels of development. This travels through an area that allows public service infrastructure, which is what this is, and it also travels through a part of the Pinelands, the forest area, which allows public service infrastructure with certain conditions.
Wow.
And so that kind of raises the bar a little bit. But this will definitely go back to court in some way, shape, or form.
Is that going to delay them the construction of this pipeline, or is South Jersey, are they going to go ahead with construction? Can you tell?
To be determined, I think.
Determined.
I mean, the court hasn't issued a stay on construction yet, even though I believe it was asked for before by the PPA and other groups. Maybe once they start construction, that irreparable harm argument will kind of be more present and the court might allow it, but it hasn't happened yet.
Let me read a tweet from AG Drums, who says, the makeup of the commission is indeed different. Pro-pipeline members replace those opposing. Christie stacked the deck. We're almost out of time here, Joe, but do you want to weigh in on that at all?
Well, he did change the chairman of the commission to a guy named Sean Erlin, who is a county appointee who supports the pipeline. The previous chairman, a guy named Mark Lobauer, opposed it, but he's still on the commission. I mean, tied last time it was voted on, and the application has changed, and a few things have happened since then. We'll see how it goes in the future.
Well, Joe, thanks for getting
Marty.
Us up to speed on this important issue. That's Joe Hernandez from WHYY, part of our news department, and he's been following the pipeline story in New Jersey. He was there on Friday for the vote. Well, we're going to take a very short break, and then we're going to go 235 trillion miles away for some good news. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And now for some good news. 235 trillion miles away, the discovery of seven new planets about the size of planet Earth circling a dwarf star. Scientists are thrilled for a whole host of reasons, including the possibility some of the planets are warm enough for water and that could sustain life. Here's Thomas Zurbuchen of NASA with the announcement.
I'm excited to announce today that Dr. Michel Gion and his team have used our Spitzer Space Telescope to determine that there are actually seven Earth-sized planets orbiting the nearby TRAPPIST-1 star about 40 light years away. What's more, as you can see in this illustration, is that three of these planets, marked in green, are in the habitable zone where liquid water can pool on the surface. In fact, with the right atmospheric conditions, there could be water on any of these planets.
Eric Jensen joining us here in our Philadelphia studio, a professor of astronomy at Swarthmore College, also director of the Frank Adelot Foundation for the Advancement of the Liberal Arts. And Eric Jensen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let me give out that phone number again because we're shifting gears, talking about exoplanets. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times with any questions or comments. So, Eric, a very earthly question. How big a deal is this?
So I think it's a huge deal. It's what's cool to me about it. So I was trying to think about this. You know, on the one hand, we have known about planets outside our solar system for about 20 years now. First ones were discovered in 1995. And we know of several thousand now, between 3,000 and 5,000, depending on how you count the ones you're not quite positive about. And so you might say, well, why is it a big deal to find these? And what's amazing to me about it is not just finding an Earth-like planet, which or Earth-sized and Earth-mass planet around another star, but finding seven of them all in the same place, all packed in very close to the star. So that says something to me about how common planet formation must be, that the universe just seems to be littered with planets.
Of which we are among them. But is the fact that these new planets are Earth-sized, is that important? The fact that they, are, and you say mass as well, seem to have this kind of similarity with planet Earth?
I think it is. I mean, I think that's what part of what makes it resonate more with me, and I imagine with other people as well, to think that we're finding something that, although it's much different in some ways, could be in some ways like our own Earth. When we first started finding planets around other stars, we found the ones that were easiest to find, which are big ones like Jupiter or even bigger than that. And the technological challenge of finding the much smaller planets was dramatic enough that I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit that maybe 10 years ago I used to tell my students, I think we'll eventually find Earth-like planets around other stars, but maybe not in my lifetime. But I also did say, maybe to slightly recover there, that I said, but I also hate to bet against how clever people can be and how they can marshal technology to do amazing things that even a few years ago we didn't think was going to be possible.
And so maybe how great telescopes are.
Yeah, that's right. Right. So telescopes and the use of the telescopes and the, you know, figuring out the right technique for the right kind of system, and also finding that there are systems that of a kind like this one that we just didn't think would even exist.
Well, help us understand, and again, another very earthly question here, but looking through the telescopes, it's not as if they saw these planets the way we might see Jupiter.
That's
Mars
right.
At
that's
night.
Right. So
what did they actually see that told them they had found something?
Right. So what's cool in some ways is that we don't have any pictures of these planets. I mean, so you might say, well, that's not cool because we'd like to see what they look like, and that's true. But it's amazing how much information they're able to pull out from not having a picture. So we have what these telescopes see is a star, a faint, dim star. And what the way that they infer the presence of planets is by measuring very carefully the brightness of that star over a long period of time. And it happens that this system is lined up just exactly edge on. So those planets are going around in a very flat plane, and we're looking right at the edge of that plane. So all of these planets pass in front of the star. They eclipse the star. And so we can't see the planets as separate dots of light, but we can see periodic dips in the star's brightness when each planet passes in front of the star. And so that's what seeing each of those dips repeat on a regular basis is what tells us that those planets are
there.
Wow.
I mean, sort of the shadow in a way, shadow of the planet.
In a way, the shadow, right, but only as if, you know, you're not seeing an actual shadow, but you're just seeing, like, on a cloudy day, it gets darker and then it gets brighter. You don't have to see the thing that's blocking it to know that there's less light than there was before. And that, in fact, the amount of dimming is how we can figure out how big the planets are. So if we know how big the star is, and we do have very good measurements of that, then we can measure what fraction of the star's light gets blocked, and that tells us how big the planet is compared to the star. So that's what lets us figure out that these things have radii that are about like Earth's radius.
One of the things that I was reading was that they're rocky or they could be rocky. How would we know that from
right.
such
so,
a distance?
So this is another piece of deduction. So we can, from the amount of dimming, we can get the radius of each planet, but that doesn't tell us whether it's an Earth-sized planet made of gas or an Earth-sized planet made of rock. But because these planets are all packed so close together, as they orbit the star, they're close enough that they sort of jostle each other a little bit. And so if there were only one planet going around this star, the eclipses would just be regular as clockwork. It would be exactly the same time every time. What we see instead is that some of these individual eclipses, which happen between every one day and about every 15 or 20 days, when you watch one of those closely, you'll find that sometimes it comes 5 or 10 minutes early, sometimes it comes maybe 2 or 10 or 20 minutes late, and you can do a calculation that fits that all together in a puzzle that says, okay, you're only going to get those particular delays if this planet, you know, number 3, has a mass that's about 1.5 times Earth. I don't know if that's the right mass
sure.
for that, but they're
sure.
about they're around Earth mass, and so we can infer how big the planets, how much mass the planets have to have in order to jostle each other and cause those slight speed ups or delays in the orbits. And so then once we have the mass combined with the size, then we can say, okay, what's the density of that planet? If you have that much mass and that much volume, then you get a density that's about like a rocky or partly rocky, partly metallic planet like Earth.
I heard the word habitable, and of course, this is part of this quest to find a planet that can sustain water. The idea of water could possibly sustain life. 3 of these planets possibly, maybe, could sustain water? Is that sort of where scientists are at this
point?
Yeah,
that's right. And depending on how – so there's 3 that are really good candidates for being – for having – surface temperatures that are very similar to Earth's surface temperature. And then if you stretch things a little bit, I don't mean stretch things, but there's things get less certain as you get farther to the edges. Closer
right.
in ones are going to be a little hotter, farther out ones are going to be a little bit cooler. But there could be, just the way we have variation in temperature across Earth's surface, there could be parts of those surfaces that are close to that right temperature for liquid water.
Of course, Mars is in a habitable zone, right?
It's sort of on the edge of it. We think, you know, Mars, the surface of Mars now is too cold for liquid water. We have good evidence that it was warmer and wetter in the past. And so even over the even for a given planet, over the history of its lifetime, those conditions can change. But yeah, it's sort of right on the edge of what might be habitable.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Eric Jensen, our second of 3 guests in this portion of Radio Times, professor of astronomy at Swarthmore College, also director of the Frank Adelot Foundation for the Advancement of the Liberal Arts. And we are talking about the discovery announced last week of 7 planets orbiting a dwarf star in a nearby solar system. And if you want to join our conversation, questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So these 7 planets are orbiting what's described or is called a dwarf star. What does that mean?
So what that means in this case is that it's a star that is quite a bit smaller and cooler than our sun. So the radius of that star is only about a tenth of the radius of the sun, and the temperature is less than half of our sun. You know, I said the radius is a tenth. Radius is maybe not the best thing to think of. So if the radius is a tenth, that means the volume of it is only 1/1,000th. In the press conference announcing the discovery, the lead scientist on this compared if our sun were a basketball, then this star would be about the size of a golf ball. So it's a tiny, tiny star. In fact, it's so small that it's just right on the edge of being a star at all. If it were just a little bit less massive, it never would have gotten hot enough to start fusion in its core and to sort of light up as a star. So it's quite small.
And that's significant? I mean, the fact that
I think it's significant in the sense that we're starting to expand our understanding of the range of systems that can have planets. And so the first thing that people did when they were hunting for planets was to target stars like the sun, because we knew that at least one case that a star like the sun had planets around it, and we discovered that a lot of those stars, in fact, did. And now people have expanded it, and it's really starting to seem like – so this goes all the way down to as small a star as you can get. And when we look at smaller stars, when we look at bigger stars, it really seems like almost every star forms planets around it, that planets are extremely common around a whole host of different kinds of stars. And conditions, of course, in those systems are different because their sun is very different from ours. And so when we talk about these planets being habitable, the only way that's possible is to be right next to that star. If these planets were at Earth's distance from the star, they would be freezing cold because the star is only about 1/2,000th as powerful as our sun. And so to be warm enough, you got to snuggle up right close to it to get some heat from it.
And and scientists believe that is true, then these planets are hugging this dwarf star?
That's right. I mean, maybe not literally hugging, but very close. So Mercury
in astronomical terms.
That's right. In relative terms. Mercury is the closest in planet to the sun in our solar system. And we think, or at least I think of it as very close in and very hot. With these seven planets, the farthest out one of them is six times closer to the star than Mercury is to our sun.
Oh, wow.
So these things are just right next to the star. They go around the star just every few days. So a year on one of these planets is somewhere from 1.5 days for the closest in one to maybe 2 or 3 weeks for the farthest out one.
And we're talking about something that's 40 light years away, 235 trillion miles.
That's right.
Is that considered close?
That's very close in astronomical terms. So one of the funny things about astronomy is that your reference point for distances changes. But this is very, very close, just right around the block in our galactic neighborhood.
So what happens next? And I should add, what I found so interesting is that you've got telescopes around the world. You've got people, in a sense, stationed around the world who are looking at these planets, this dwarf star, and conferring and working together to try to understand what it is that they're seeing.
That's right. And that's a common way that that science operates now. And in particular, this science of discovering planets around other stars, when you have these little eclipses, you can predict when the next one is going to happen because you see them regularly like ticks on a clock. And if we wanted to go observe one, the prediction might be that the next one is going to happen in the daytime for us. But it's nighttime somewhere on Earth. And so if you have telescopes distributed around the globe, then that gives you more capability to follow up on some of these things.
Let me see what David from looks like Roxborough has to say. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. One of my interests is not just habitable life or life that has even complex life, but life that can give rise to a civilization, which means land-based life. And I remember reading earlier that maybe we are extremely unique, maybe alone in the universe, practically alone, because of a very unlikely incident that happened when a Mars-like object had collided with the Earth, forming our moon and removing most of our crust, allowing for plate tectonics and for continents to arise, without which we would just be a water world.
Well, David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and there always is that are we alone kind of – it's both a scientific question, but it's a philosophical one as well.
Yeah, that's right. So to the specific question that was asked there, I think that we're still in the process of figuring out what these other planets that we call Earth-like, but what Earth-like there really means is we're confident about the size, we're confident about the mass, we're pretty confident about the composition that there's rock in that planet. What the surface looks like in terms of oceans versus land, we don't have the technology to do that yet, though we hope to get there. But I don't think that the thinking is that continents should necessarily be that unusual. exact fraction is going to be determined. It's unusual for us to have a moon that's as big as our moon is, and it was a result of an impact, as our caller said. But I think we likely would have had land and oceans anyway. People do talk about whether the moon has helped protect us from giant impacts from other things. So that's a different part of it. But figuring out how common life is definitely part of the picture. But knowing Earth-like planets are there is a first step.
Well, and it's also how we define life. Obviously, water means something to us. Would it mean something to another organism?
That's right. There are arguments both ways. And there are one of the things we do know is that in the one case where we know of life in the universe, water was an important part of that. And there are general properties of water that make us think that it's likely to exist elsewhere. And so while I think it's unlikely that water is the only basis of life elsewhere, I also think it's pretty likely that it may be a very common basis of life elsewhere. So it gives us a place to start.
So what happens next? I mean, what's the next move when it comes to looking at this discovery?
Sure. Right. Well, you can bet that lots of people meaning astronomers in this case, will be paying attention to this system and continuing to follow it up. We know of 7 planets in this system now. There could easily be more than that, which would be a little bit crazy. But the farther out from the star you go, the longer it takes for each planet to orbit. Right. And so the longer you have to wait, the fewer eclipses of that given planet you're going to see. And so people are going to keep watching for that. Another thing that we'll be able to do that's really pushing it technologically, but not impossible with a new generation of telescopes, is for these very small planets passing in front of the star, if they have an atmosphere, part of the light from the star will pass through the gases in that atmosphere and maybe leave a little bit of a signature on it that could tell us whether the atmosphere is there, and if so, what it's made of. So we might start to be able to get a sense of whether these planets have atmospheres or not.
Why would it be crazy if there were more than 7 planets? Why is that a crazy idea?
It's not crazy. I mean, it's probably true, in fact, but it just seems like such a a wealth of planets, which is great.
No. Unfortunately, we can't take Pam's question. She's calling us from Chester County. She says, do they have moons?
We don't know. We don't know yet. My bet would be probably not, just because they're so close together. They probably formed farther out. They might have formed with moons initially. They have sort of gotten locked into a pattern that has gradually moved in closer to the star over time. And I mentioned them sort of jostling each other, and that's how we could determine their masses. My guess is that would destabilize moons around them pretty quickly.
Pam, sorry, I couldn't take your call, but we were able to get your question on the air. Eric Jensen, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times, getting us all excited about this discovery.
Thank you very much. I'm excited too, and it was fun to talk about it.
Absolutely. And he's a professor of astronomy at Swarthmore College. After this very short break, we'll be talking about what happened late last night at the Academy Awards. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times.
Guys, I'm sorry. No, there's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won.
Come on, this is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture. Moonlight, Best Picture.
This is very unfortunate what happened. Personally, I blame Steve Harvey for this. I would like to see you get an Oscar anyway. Why can't we just give out a whole bunch of them?
I'm going to be really proud to hand this to my friends from Moonlight.
That was the awkward and embarrassing end to last night's Academy Awards ceremony when the Oscar for Best Picture was taken away from La La Land and given to Moonlight before a confused audience of Hollywood celebrities and millions who stayed up late to watch. Apparently, presenters Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty were given the wrong envelope. Today, we want to talk about last night's event, including the snafu, plus who won and lost, and what, if anything, it says about making movies. And joining us is Hilary Busis of Hollywood editor for Vanity Fair. And Hilary, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times for your reaction to last night. Hilary, who has the biggest egg on their face this morning?
Well, PricewaterhouseCooper has officially taken the blame for the envelope mix-up last night. They issued a statement late around 3 in the morning apologizing to Moonlight, La La Land, Warren Beatty, Faye Dunaway, and Oscar viewers. But the Academy has said that it's investigating the matter. They are still kind of trying to figure out what happened, how the wrong envelope got into Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway's hands. So it might be a little more time before we learn what really happened.
I'm thinking of those locked suitcases that we see, the level of security, almost like the the nuclear codes as the Academy Awards gets underway.
Yeah, it's incredible that they go to great lengths to make sure that things like this don't happen. There are only two people in the entire world, supposedly, who know who the winners are before they're announced. They're two PricewaterhouseCooper accountants. They stand on either side of the stage with a locked briefcase that contains envelopes that reveal all 24 winners in all the categories. But somehow Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway were given the envelope saying that Emma Stone had won Best Actress. They saw that Faye Dunaway saw the words La La Land and said that La La Land had won Best Picture, even though she was looking at the wrong envelope.
And clearly Warren Beatty wasn't exactly sure what he was looking at. As you look at the tape again, you can understand why he was hemming and hawing.
Exactly. At the beginning, as we were all watching live, it just seemed like he was taking his time. Nobody could tell that there was something crazy about to happen and completely unpredictable.
So how did La La Land handle this?
They handled it with great grace. I think that, you know, given the circumstances, we probably couldn't have expected anything better. La La Land producer Jordan Horowitz was the one who sort of took charge and announced that Moonlight was the rightful winner. He took to the mic. He made sure that everybody at home watching knew that he was not joking. He wasn't, you know, being Adele saying that Beyonce deserved the award more than she did. Although there was a little, it seemed to be echoing that incident at the Grammys before Moonlight finally got to take the stage and accept the award that they had rightfully earned.
Do you think the best film won? I have to admit, in my book, I was rooting for Moonlight.
I was rooting for Moonlight, too. I mean, La La Land is beautiful, it's fun, it's exuberant, but Moonlight is just so poetic and a movie unlike any other movie I think that's ever won Best Picture, which sets it apart. And it's probably a more important movie than La La Land, also, in the end. And importance doesn't necessarily translate to... it depends on how you judge movies, but I agree that Moonlight deserves this.
Well, I thought story, acting, script, filmmaking, I mean, it kind of hit all the major food groups when it comes to a really good film. Do you think there was a La La Land backlash? Because I have to say, a couple of weeks ago, it seemed like they were going to just walk away with all the big awards last night.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there was some element of that because La La Land was the presumptive winner basically all of award season, that there may have been a lot of Oscar voters who didn't put it at the top of their preferential ballots for Best Picture. And for the Best Picture award, everybody ranks the nominees, so it's possible for something to be, for a lot of voters to, you know, say put Moonlight second and something else first, and then Moonlight ends up winning because it was ranked highly on so many different ballots, even though it wasn't necessarily number one on everybody's ballot.
Yeah, and did they really get to celebrate it? I mean, it was so confusing on stage.
It was, and it's a shame that they didn't really get to enjoy their moment, and that their moment is always sort of going to be tied up in this mistake.
And that's Hilary Busis. She's a Hollywood editor for Vanity Fair. We are talking about last night's, very early morning, certainly here on the East Coast, Academy Awards ceremony. And again, if you want to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. What film would have gotten your vote? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to play another clip, and Jimmy Kimmel was the host and had his hands full last night, but let me just play a clip where he essentially is roasting actress Meryl Streep.
We're also here to honor the actors who seem great, but actually really aren't. And of all the great actors here in Hollywood, one in particular has stood the test of time for her many uninspiring and overrated performances. From her mediocre early work in The Deer Hunter and Out of Africa to her underwhelming performances in Kramer versus Kramer and Sophie's Choice, Meryl Streep has phoned it in for more than 50 films over the course of her lackluster career. This is Meryl's 20th Oscar nomination.
Well, Hillary, I think we know who he was really roasting last night.
Yes, there was. It was no secret that many of the winners and presenters last night are not exactly fans of Donald Trump and did not try to hide their feelings on the podium.
How do you think Jimmy Kimmel did? It's not an easy job, and there are a lot of people that have preceded him. Some obviously have done better than others. How did he do?
I think he did a great job. I think that he struck the right tone. He was a little harsh at times. I think that his Matt Damon jokey feud bit may have come back a few too many times during the ceremony, but generally speaking, he kept things moving. He was funny. I enjoyed his tour bus bit when he brought a bunch of unsuspecting Los Angeles civilians, I guess, into the Dolby Theater. Somehow they were unaware that the Oscars were happening that night, which I find a little hard to believe, but I will go with it for the sake of the bit. And it ended up producing some funny moments.
Yes, it did. And some interesting kind of back and forth with the celebrities or the Hollywood celebrities sitting in the front row and mixing up with the masses.
Yes.
And what is this whole Matt Damon thing that Jimmy Kimmel was pushing last night?
So Jimmy Kimmel and Matt Damon have been pretending to feud since 2005. It's insane to think that this has been going on for literally 12 years.
Wow.
It all started with an off-the-cuff joke on Jimmy Kimmel Live. He was at the end of his show. He thought it would be funny to say that they had run out of time to have on Matt Damon as a guest. Of course, Matt Damon was not actually booked on the show, but then Jimmy Kimmel started saying that at the end of every show. Eventually, Matt Damon came on, and then it just kind of grew and grew and grew, and it's still happening now.
In fact, when he came out to present an award, it was Ben Affleck and...
And the guest.
And guest, right? They didn't even say his name.
And Kimmel also took shots at We Bought a Zoo, a maybe little remembered Matt Damon flop, which I thought was one of his funnier moments. He also kind of relished in the fact that Matt Damon was probably going to lose the Oscar that he was nominated for as a producer of Manchester by the Sea, which did not win Best Picture.
And on and on and on it goes. Some
yes.
of the speakers did get political. It seemed that they were more foreign, either directors or people who were involved in films, talking about the refugee ban, talking about immigration and things like that.
Yes, which makes sense because there are a lot of immigrants obviously involved in Hollywood, a lot of descendants of immigrants. The most powerful statement probably came from the Iranian director of the winner for Best Foreign Film, The Salesman. He did not come to the ceremony in protest of Donald Trump's travel ban, but he was represented on stage by the first Iranian woman in space, who read a statement that he had prepared in which he talked about division and uniting and about how filmmakers can use their platform to unite people. It was a powerful moment.
Yes, indeed. Let's go through some of the categories here. For Best Picture, Arrival, Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, La La Land, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. Hillary, I have to say that's a really excellent list of movies.
It is. It was a strong year.
And does that tell us something about Hollywood?
I think it's been a pretty good time for movies lately, despite the fact that box office receipts are generally on a downward trend. But if nothing else, you know, streaming has meant that there are a lot more people who can get involved and who can make movies. Amazon and Netflix both came away from the Oscars last night with their first Oscars ever, which indicates that they're only going to become more powerful in this market, going to give more, maybe smaller films an opportunity to find an audience because, in an era where movie theaters are filled up by these big, giant franchise movies, it can be difficult for something smaller to get attention, which is where Netflix and Amazon and other streaming services can come in.
Yeah, which is so fascinating. Best Director for either Arrival, Hacksaw Ridge, La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. Damien Chazelle got it for La La Land.
And he is the youngest person ever to win Best Director.
How old is he? Because I was looking at him thinking, he looks really young.
He is, I believe, 31.
Wow.
Which is pretty remarkable.
We had actually a tweet from one of our listeners, T. Denise, says the best director for me was Denzel Washington. Now, he wasn't nominated. He was nominated in the best actor category for Fences. I saw that. I thought it was a very powerful adaptation of a really powerful play.
Yes, definitely. And he won a Tony Award for playing that same part on Broadway. There were some prognosticators who thought that he might be able to have a last-minute Best Actor surge and win the award. In the end, it went to Casey Affleck, who had won a lot of the precursor awards to Best Actor. So his win was not a surprise. If Denzel Washington had come in, won a third Oscar, then that would have been another upset.
Well, Viola Davis did win an Oscar and had a really very emotional and moving speech.
Yes, definitely. That was one of the highlights of the night. Viola Davis nominated three times, once for lead actress before this, once for supporting actress. She ended up winning in the supporting actress category for Fences, which was actually a little bit of a controversial choice. She has what was arguably a leading performance in the movie. She won a lead actress Tony Award for playing this part on Broadway, but she submitted herself in the supporting actress category, arguably because it would have been easier for her to win. There's less competition there. So she did win, but it's maybe tinged with some bittersweetness in that she didn't go for best actress, which she probably would have been very competitive in.
Well,
if she had chosen to compete there.
And here are the women who were in the best actress category: Isabelle Huppert for Elle, Ruth Negga in Loving, Natalie Portman, Jackie, Emma Stone, La La Land, who won, and Meryl Streep for Florence Foster Jenkins. Emma Stone winning the Best Actress award. I was surprised that Loving didn't get more nominations, considering I just thought what an intimate and beautiful film that was.
Yeah, it can be tough for Intimate and Beautiful to compete with colorful,
yes, exactly,
and musical.
What,
especially at the Oscars.
Especially at the Oscars. Any surprise about Emma Stone?
No, I think that this was another thing we could have seen coming. She won the Golden Globe. She's won several of the other awards leading up to the Oscars. And I think that she's just a very well-liked, charming presence and had a lot of fans, obviously.
Mahershala Ali getting Best Supporting Actor for Moonlight, and I think a lot of people felt that they were pretty confident that he would win that Oscar.
They were, yeah. He did hit a couple of snags on his road to the Oscar. He lost the Golden Globe to Aaron Taylor Johnson for Nocturnal Animals, which was a huge upset, but the Hollywood Foreign Press is always unpredictable, so we probably shouldn't have necessarily taken that as a sign that Mahershala Ali would not go on to win the Oscar. And he ended up winning,
yep,
which was very, very great to see. He gave a very moving speech.
What was the highlight for you last night?
Of the awards in general?
I
mean, it's tough to... I feel sorry that Moonlight couldn't just enjoy its big Best Picture win, but I have to say it's very exciting to see, you know, to be reminded that this is actually live television, that anything can happen, that something, that a mistake this huge can happen. I don't know. I think it really injected a bolt of electricity into an awards show that had been fairly predictable up until that point. I mean, you know, they announced La La Land. All of us who were watching kind of rolled our eyes and said, okay,
right,
saw that coming, and we're settling back. I mean, it went on for almost 2 minutes before everybody on stage realized that Moonlight had actually won. That's probably the biggest surprise of all, is that the mistake wasn't caught immediately.
Well, you could see after a minute or two people sort of running back and forth behind the among the cast and crew of La La Land. There was clearly something was afoot.
Yes, definitely. If you analyze it closely, I think a lot of people are sort of treating that as the Zapruder film, trying to find the exact moment where everything went wrong. And I think that we'll be analyzing it for a long time to come.
It's nice to see Katherine Johnson on stage. She's the real life mathematician, part of NASA, also part of this film, Hidden Figures.
Yes, definitely. Hidden Figures ended up going home empty-handed, which was a little disappointing for such a crowd pleaser. It was one of the movies that earned the most out of any Best Picture nominee, had a lot of popular support, but not quite enough to get one of the Oscars. I think it maybe got started a little late in award season. and didn't have time to build up the same momentum as the other movies, which is a shame.
Well, Hillary, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That's Hillary Busis, Hollywood editor for Vanity Fair. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.